Resolute is one of the northernmost continuously occupied settlements in the world. The average temperature only peaks above freezing for July and August, and the sun doesn't come out for 4 months in the winter. Agriculture is impossible. Who would willingly settle in such a place? The answer is nobody. I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. I should clarify, the Inuit sent north to Resolute and its sister colony, Grease Ford, went willingly, but they went under false pretenses. They also had, or quickly developed, a dependency on the Canadian government, which makes it hard to determine exactly how willing the participants were. These concerns have present-day consequences. Some feel that the relocated have still not been properly compensated for the hardships they endured. So, why were Inuit sent to the high Arctic? That takes some explaining. But first, some more context. European colonizers in the Americas used conflicting policies to exploit American Indians, alternating between encouraging assimilation and then exaggerating conflict to whittle away at the few rights the European systems had granted them. It's the exact same strategy they used to exploit Jews for millennia in Europe. These statements might sound kind of controversial from a political perspective, but the historical record is very clear. We can argue about what to do about these facts, but we have a duty to confront them, even if that makes us uncomfortable. History has a way of butting up into politics. That's because we live in a hand-me-down world. We inhabit societies that predate us and occupy social structures that we didn't create. One of those structures is the law. Despite the huge diversity in what's considered ethically right across cultures and times, all peoples have notions of fair and unfair ways to treat people, and a system, often flawed, for demanding that justice. Every society has codes for how they treat others and how they treat themselves. Europeans who arrived in the Americas came from societies with complex systems of land rights that involved laws and contracts and treaties, and these codes were a crucial part of their idea of fairness. These were also the tools they used to legitimize their conquest of the Americas. They were as incomprehensible to the American Indians as the American social structures were to the Europeans. Increasing evidence has suggested that American Indians had complex and extensive settlements throughout the continental U.S., and their weapons and military tactics were comparable in effectiveness to the Europeans. The American Indians found Europeans as weak and childlike as the Europeans found them. Those who suggest that the American conquest was a foregone conclusion haven't appreciated how much luck and failure early European adventurers experienced. American Indians actually were successful in throwing back Europeans in many of the early confrontations where that was their goal. But what began as a stupidly lucky conquest of Mexico and an utterly tenacious colony on the Chesapeake Bay, with the help of an epidemic the likes of which humanity has never seen before or since, became an unstoppable machine of laws and contracts and treaties, as well as guns, germs, and steel. And European societies conquered the continents. I live in Colorado, and I can attest it's very uncomfortable to study how Colorado was settled. I was initially defensive when I started learning the history of my own state, because anyone with eyes and a heart can look at it and say, this land was not taken in a fair way. And that brings into question my own legitimacy in living here as a product of white Western society. It can be a very emotional topic, and a legally precarious one, because even though we can point out the laws and treaties that say we have a right to be here, there's still that nagging worry that if the conquest was this unjust, how can I really claim to have a right to live here? But if I'm going to talk about the history of Colorado, I have to confront these facts, because they're just that. Facts. There are bones under the battlefields of Colorado, and they're not just the bones of brave warriors, they're the bones of old men and women and children who were shot down in their tents. These facts are embedded into the ground that I walk on. The record is clear. The past is the past. And these are the topics I want to discuss today: legitimacy, fairness, and how politics confronts the past. The events I've just mentioned happened between 100 and 500 years ago. and I find that somewhat hard to relate to. It was a time when mainstream science considered some races to be lesser than others. It was a time when empire was considered a good thing. Europe and the world underwent a huge shift in World War II, and the Allies emerged with a much different view of their own empires. So I'm going to talk about something that happened after Canada gained its legislative independence in 31, after the Irish declared themselves a free state in 37, even after Indian independence in 47. It was a time when the British Empire had given up on empire. This happened in the 50s. Still a time of hubris, but an essentially modern time for race and culture. And plus, there's a twist in this story. The Canadian government used Inuit to colonize formerly Inuit lands. So, I knew about the horrors of the American conquest, and I was also aware of how Australian society subdued and undermined Aboriginal Australian society. But I was not aware, until I started researching polar exploration, that Canada has a particularly contentious and late contribution to the mistreatment of Aboriginal populations. In 1953, authorities and the Canadian government embarked on a social experiment that separated families and actively harmed its participants, largely because of the government's high-handedness and cultural incomprehension. It's a case study in what colonization looks like in the post-World War II world. Motivated by many of the same impulses that colonization had for the previous half millennium, but perpetrated by a society that really should have known better. So here's what happened. In 1953, the Canadian government relocated seven families from northern Quebec to the high Arctic, creating the northernmost settlements in the Americas, and did not provide a way for them to return to their former communities, as had been promised. These are the facts. Even the most defensive appraisal of the project has to admit, those are the facts. In 2010, the Canadian government admitted that the experiment was marked by, quote, mistakes and broken promises. Here's why. And real quick, before I jump too deeply into the history, let's talk about nomenclature. In my North Pole podcast, I said Inuits a bunch of times to pluralize Inuit. That's wrong. Inuit is already plural. They are the Inuk people, and Inuk means the people. The people who live in the Arctic had no term for Arctic peoples in general, so Westerners generalized them as Eskimo. Eskimo remains the most accepted term for talking about polar people in general. Inuk and Inuit refers to a specific culture that lives in northern Canada. The Inuit of Greenland prefer to be called Greenlanders. There's similar reasoning to why I'm calling the peoples of America the American Indians as well. They, again, had no term for Americans in general, and Europeans called them Indians after Columbus's mistake. Long, long after it had become clear that the Caribbean islands are not the Indies. The terms American and Indian and Native all have historical and geographic problems, so I'm just following the consensus of today, which is American Indian. I have no doubt that this whole discussion of terminology will be obsolete in the near future. The Inuk people came to Canada starting in 1000 CE. And it appears that they reached the east coast of Canada right around the same time as the Norse did from the other side of the Atlantic. Anthropologists refer to the Proto-Inuit culture as the Thule people. The term Thule comes from an ancient Greek term for the island furthest north in the world, which came to be the name of an island off of Greenland, which is where the first Thule artifacts were discovered. So that's where the name comes from. The Thule spread out from the area around Alaska, across Canada, and into the area formerly occupied by the Dorset people, an area that is now the north and east coasts of Canada. It might be worth pulling up Google Earth or a globe, looking at a globe for this episode, because you're probably used to seeing this area on maps, and virtually all mapping projections warp this area beyond recognition. On a globe, you can actually see the shortest path, the one that the Thule took, goes along the north coast into Nunavut and into the Arctic islands, eventually reaching Greenland. it's very peculiar to note that there's no evidence of cultural or genetic mixing between the Dorset people and the Thule people who replaced them. Seemingly, the Dorset died out before the Thule arrived. A possible explanation for this is climate change. The Dorset developed their hunting and living techniques in a time when the Arctic was relatively cold. Starting around 900 CE, the Earth went through a period of warming, called the Medieval Warm Period. This perhaps made the climate more similar to the Alaskan climate, where the Thule developed. It's also worth noting that the Dorset did not have dogs. The Thule used dogs for travel and for hunting, which conferred a huge survival advantage, and which influenced their culture, which helps us tell them apart in the archaeological record. The warm period also allowed the Norse to expand into Iceland, and then the southern and western coast of Greenland, and then finally to Baffin Island and the Canadian mainland, which was an area they called Vinland. It's also worth noting that the Norse had virtually no effect on the Thule culture or genes either. What interactions they had with medieval Europe were apparently brief and superficial. And as they begin to enter now the written history period of time, we can start referring to the Thule as Inuk. The Inuk historically live semi-nomadically, usually moving between a few different sites throughout the year. They were a primarily maritime people, and you can see that in the way that they spread, hugging the north coast of Canada and spreading across islands. Unlike most hunter-gatherer people, the Inuk diet actually is predominantly animal-based, things like seal, muskox, fish, and shellfish. As much as 75% of their caloric intake is fat. This is predominantly because they live north of the Arctic tree line, where the plant growth is sparse. You can see that on a map, too. The Inuk stopped their southern expansion when they ran into the First Nations people that lived around the Great Lakes and the northeast coast of the U.S., and they relied more on settled and agricultural survival techniques. The Inuk couldn't displace them. They had a wrong set of strategies. There's an Inuk saying that the great peril of our existence lies in the fact that our diet consists entirely of souls, and it's kind of hard to disagree with that if you imagine animals also having souls. The benefit of this reliance on animal meat is that it provides a source of vitamin C during the long, dark winters. The Inuk hunted in kayaks and animal skin rafts. It's possible that the first Americans used rafts just like these to sail from Beringia, where trees are very scarce, but game is very common, to the Pacific Northwest, where they settled, and then peopled the rest of the Americas from. The Inuk lived closely with their dogs, sleeping, hunting, and traveling together. They created intricate stone tools, they expressed themselves with wooden carving and song and stories, and they conquered the North from Alaska to Greenland. You can see how a period of global warming allowed the Inuk to prosper. So you can also imagine how a period of global cooling affected them. It's a fact of geography that at the same latitude, Alaska and Scandinavia are much warmer than Canada. This is a result of the direction of the sea currents and the influence of the Hudson Bay. The Hudson Bay is this huge, shallow inland sea, and it acts as a cold sink. For the period lasting from roughly 1300 to 1850 CE, the earth cooled. In Europe, harvest shrank, and the hunger caused unprecedented political disruption that forged much of the Western European culture that we now know, and it pushed Europeans to the sea to find new places to live. For the Norse, the far-flung colonies of Vinland and Greenland could no longer be sustained. The last Greenland sites occupied by the Norse were abandoned in the 1400s. For the Inuk, much of their former territory became uninhabitable. The seas froze around the northern islands of Canada, and the Inuk were forced south. Ellesmere Island, which runs alongside northern Greenland, was finally abandoned in the 1500s. The Little Ice Age ended transatlantic contact, but only for about a century. Canadian colonization had a slightly different character than American colonization, but there's obviously a lot of overlap, as they are geographically contiguous colonies of the British Empire. But initial native interaction with Europe and Canada and around the Great Lakes area was with the French and Dutch rather than the English, and they had a much more hands-off policy compared to other colonizers. Their interest was predominantly in trade, rather than production like the Spanish or land like the English. Exploitation was still the main goal, but they saw the American Indians more as partners in that quest than other Europeans did. Even after Britain took over the Dutch and French possessions in North America in a conflict that British colonists called the French and Indian War, the sparsely populated far north continued to be administered by a laissez-faire combination of private companies, religious missions, and increasingly military outposts. There wasn't really a serious attempt to settle this area. Generally speaking, religious missions provided most of what we consider public services, things like education and healthcare, while the Hudson's Bay Company traded furs for common goods like cigarettes and tools and supplementary food, often in a form of company credit. They invented this sort of pseudo-currency called Made Beaver, MB, which is worth one prepared adult male beaver pelt. So prices were written in MBs. During the 20th century, many more military bases, mostly American, were created in Inuk-occupied areas, and Inuk communities came increasingly to congregate around these military presences because they made acquiring goods easier. They were sort of de facto trading posts. Over time, these communities became more and more reliant on settled society, and they started to integrate into Canadian society. The resulting pattern is the same you see over and over again in history. They took the jobs that were at the bottom and at the edges of these white societies, living partly on assistance and partly on temporary manual labor for the men and temporary domestic work for women. By the 1950s, many formerly nomadic Inuit had formed impoverished, uneducated, and dependent classes on the edge of Canadian society, and they were prone to unemployment, illness, poverty, and crime. They had become the, quote, Eskimo problem. That was how the Canadian government saw it anyway. This is how Markusi Patsawa remembers it.
In those days, we did not depend on entirely on the Hudson's Bay. We were living out of the land much more than we were getting our supplies. We used to go to the Hudson's Bay store to get a flour, tea, those little things. But they were not our main food. We survived from the land. We've been surviving from the land for centuries. And at that time in the 1950s, we were still nomadic people.
A committee was called that involved all interested parties: the Northern Administration, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the churches, the Hudson's Bay Company, and the National Health and Welfare Administration. Notably, no Inuit were invited. It was thought that the language and cultural barriers would make their input more troublesome than helpful. It was ultimately decided that the least expensive and most helpful course of action would be to resettle some Inuit in their, quote, native way of life, further north, where wildlife surveys had determined that game would be more plentiful, and the distance from settled society would produce a more independent and natural way of life. There were also concerns coming from both the American and Canadian State Departments that Canada was losing its sovereignty over the high Arctic. Sovereignty refers to who has rights over land. We live in a world with remarkably clear borders today, but through most of human history, countries have overlapped or had conflicting claims or intermingled on the edges. I've heard a very simple way to determine who has control of a piece of land. It's who the local people pay their taxes to. Everybody reports to somebody. But what about places where people don't live, or live very sporadically? In these cases, the international community looks to treaties between powers and who is enforcing laws in the area. In the high Arctic, the only real laws that need enforcing are hunting and fishing laws. So the Canadian government set up a series of mounted police outposts throughout the north, and they staffed them with skeleton crews to enforce the rule of law. Concern from the American State Department was that many of the bases and men living in the high north were American. In World War II, many air bases were constructed in the high north, and in the Cold War that followed, the U.S. Air Force flew missions to deter Soviet incursions. Again, looking at a globe, it can help you see the quickest way to nuke the U.S. from Soviet territory and vice versa would be to send something over the top, over the Arctic Circle. Concerns that the North was becoming too American led the Canadian government to pursue a policy of Canadianization, where the U.S. would hand over control and operations of certain military outposts to Canadian administration. This process was proceeding much slower than expected, mostly due to budget issues. Besides security and sovereignty, the Canadian government had a strong economic incentive to keep their rights to the North current. Increasingly, geological surveys were revealing vast deposits of untapped natural resources. Canada wanted those profits for itself. So the Canadian government had two problems and one obvious solution. How do you get the Inuit off government assistance and assert Canadian claims to the Arctic? Well, you guessed it. The answer was to relocate Inuk communities further north. In the aftermath of all this, motives became a key issue in assigning blame. Many people felt that if Inuit were indeed acting primarily as agents of the Canadian government, tasked with defending sovereignty, then they should be compensated as such. An initial report claimed that the protection of sovereignty was not a primary motive of the program. This interpretation has been disputed by many subsequent reports. But the bottom line is this: even if sovereignty wasn't the main motive in moving the Inuit north, it was the reason why Inuit were sent so far north. And being so far north is really the root of the problems. Seven families were recruited from Inukjuak, then called Port Harrison, with promises of an easier life in a place with abundant hunting and a freer lifestyle. They were accompanied by three families from Pond Inlet, an Inuk community much farther north, with the assumption that the more northerly Inuit would teach the more southerly ones how to survive. By the way, Inukjuak is the region where the 1922 film Nanook of the North was filmed. You might have heard of that film. It's considered one of the first documentaries and ethnographic films. The filmmaker falsified many parts of it to make the Inuk seem more true to history, as in true to his conception of history. But for our purposes, it's useful because it conjures up the right images of what is considered a traditional sort of climate for the Inuit. Temperatures in Inukjuak range from negative 20 in the winter to 55 in the summer, Fahrenheit. In the winter, sunlight goes down to just 1 hour a day. The diet traditionally consists of various wild leafy plants, migrating animals, and seafood including fish, shellfish, and seal.
This is how Elijah Nutarik remembers the promises.
They told us that there will be an abundance of food in the new location and that we should try it out. They also said that we could return in about 2 years.
And this is how Jabedi Amagolik remembers leaving.
On leaving this camp, I said to myself, oh well, I'll be back here in a couple of years, so I'm not going to miss it that much.
It is located around 56 and a half degrees south. Resolute and Grease Fjord are much less hospitable. The literal translations of the Inuit language names for these are the place with no dawn and the place that never thaws, respectively. Grease Fjord is about 20 degrees north of Inukjuak, a distance of 1,200 miles. It's on the southern tip of Ellesmere Island, which, as I mentioned, had former Inuk settlements on it, but had been abandoned 500 years earlier from the cold. The families were transported by boat, along with their dogs, on a 6 weeks long journey in cramped quarters, living on little more than hardtack and tea. One woman gave birth along the boat ride, although this was considered somewhat fortunate in that she was able to receive better care than was available in Inukjuak or Grease Fjord.
This is Markusi Patsawa again talking about what they found when they arrived there. And forgive the music in this clip, it's not mine.
We got into Resolute early one morning, and by afternoon it was blowing snow, and it was empty. When we got up to the High Arctic, I was expecting to see the trading post, the RCMP, the nursing station, the Anglican Church, because our life was supposed to improve. When we got up there, I was shocked. It was empty and cold.
They were given inadequate and low-quality supplies due to issues of timing and budget. And when they would alter their supplies, like, for example, adding more material to make their socks higher, they were shamed for being wasteful and not following regulations. Despite the warnings from several planners involved in the operation, no wooden buildings had been built to support the new arrivals. Instead, they were given flimsy tents to live in. The first year, there was too little snow to build igloos, so they lived in their tents, and they reinforced them with buffalo hides they had been given for blankets. These hides kept the tents warm, but also blocked out all of the sunlight, which forced the Inuk to choose between cold or darkness. Their traditional sources of food were nowhere to be found, there were no leafy plants, and crucially, no open water. And there were strict regulations imposed on caribou and musk ox hunting. The fur trapping season was already coming to an end, and that was virtually their only source of income. Getting furs to trade for supplies would be a dicey strategy anyway, because supplies had been marked up in price considerably to discourage Inuit from taking the, quote, easy way out and living off the police supplies. Besides this, resupply wouldn't arrive for another year, so the supplies that did exist had to be rationed. The Inuk did what they could to get their camp ready before winter. The sun set in November. It rose again in February. The Inuit from Inukjuak had never seen anything like it.
We were in a land that had no open water. We lived off the seal breathing holes, and when we went to the water edge, it was very dark. We sometimes would wait for hours by a fox turd, thinking it was a seal's breathing hole because it was so dark. After waiting some time for the seal to come up, we would touch the hole and discover that we had touched a fox turd.
It sounds somewhat comical, but imagine the disappointment when you're right on the edge of starvation, hunting in the dark. The relocation project, or experiment as it was called, would have ended in brutal starvation that first winter of 1953, if not for the Herculean efforts of the mounted police. The constables stationed near these new settlements had more knowledge of the Inuit language and customs than their superiors did, and had familiarity with the local wildlife patterns. So they were crucial in helping the Inuk adapt to this new environment. Despite receiving no extra supplies, the mounted police shared food, fuel, wood, and tools to help the displaced Inuit survive this harsh winter. Motivated by little more than their kindness and a sense of duty, with no instructions or support from the relocation authorities, the police worked tirelessly to help the Inuk adapt. For their trouble, they received harsh criticism from their superiors for interfering in the Inuk way of life and undermining the project of making the Inuk independent. As late as 1990, the Mounted Police were blamed by the government for the failure of this relocation project. But if not for police support, this would be a much darker story, much more similar to the stories we hear of Soviet relocations. Instead, everyone survived the first winter. But the unnecessary hardships did not end there. The Inuit were not told ahead of time that they would be split between the two settlement locations, and extended families were split at the last minute. In fact, there was yet another location even further north, which couldn't be reached due to ice conditions. If the boats had gotten through the ice, that surely would have been a death sentence. Despite numerous requests by constables working to save the Inuk communities, the Northern Administration maintained a hard line on segregating Inuk from white settlements. For example, policy stated that Inuk were not allowed to scavenge the refuse dumps near the bases, even though those refuse dumps were the only source of wood and sometimes the only available food. This policy apparently derives from a paternalistic attitude felt towards the new communities, that although it was hard to be cruel, the government needed to cut off as much assistance as possible to allow the Inuk to return to their way of life. Of course, these conditions were not native to the Inuk way of life. Virtually no one spent winter that far north without major support from civilization. This was a far harsher and scarcer environment to survive in. The Inuk had been dumped in an inhospitable wasteland without the supplies or training that their white counterparts had been given by that same government. It isn't hard to see how animosity quickly grew. While they were fighting for survival, these communities were further taken advantage of. There was a strong sentiment among the politicians responsible for the, quote, Eskimo experiment, that it should pay for itself. The Eskimo Loan Fund was created to pay for transportation and supplies, and it was expected that the Inuit work would pay it back and would be used to secure further supplies. It quickly became clear that there was very little labor that the Inuit could provide on base that didn't interfere with their own hunting and trapping activities, so that possible revenue stream was quickly dropped from the plans. The Inuit would hand over the furs that they prepared, along with quilts and figurines, in exchange for set prices determined by the administration. The credits from these set prices went into the Eskimo Loan Fund, and they were ostensibly used to provide supplies for the stores the following year. The furs would then be sold at auction by the administration. But here's the thing. Sometimes the difference between the price paid into the fund and the price that was earned at auction was 200% different. Where this profit went is unclear. It wasn't credited to the stores or the Inuk fund. And worse still, the prices in the stores were still significantly marked up from the acquisition price. In the case of luxury goods that they wanted to dissuade the Inuk from using, like cigarettes, this markup was as much as 40%. So authorities were double-dipping in this really cruel way, once not paying the price that they were getting for the furs, and then charging them huge prices for the goods that they were buying. This situation continued for 7 years until the stores were turned into Inuk cooperatives, and the communities were given control over what supplies they ordered for their own communities. To this day, the profits from this practice are unaccounted for. And then there's the issue of return. As part of the agreement to try out these distant lands, the families involved agreed that they would return home if they wanted in 2 years. It's interesting that there were very few requests to do so. It wasn't until 1957, 4 years into the project, that the government actually stopped moving more Inuit north, presumably because the communities appeared healthy. It wasn't until 1982 that the government even considered funding return trips, and even then contributed very little money to the returns. It's true that life improved after the first few years. Lumber arrived to establish permanent and better insulated homes. Fur collection increased, implying that hunting and trapping were having more success. Additional settlers, often family members from the original group, joined. And, as I said, very few requests to leave were logged. The Eskimo Loan Fund was paid off in a matter of a few years. And although many of the funds that were collected before 1960 disappeared, satisfaction improved as the government stores were converted to co-ops. Official accounts paint a fairly cheery picture of these first few years. And yet the inability for them to leave has become a major point of contention for survivors and their descendants. How do we explain this discrepancy? Well, the relocated Inuit felt a profound lack of agency. These were people who had been told that their society was sick, terribly sick, and relocation was the only way to save them. And how could they argue with this logic when the evidence was all around them? Poverty, unemployment, alcoholism. As a result, these settlers report feeling unable to argue with the authorities. There was a feeling that relocation was the only option available. It's likely that most complaints were stifled by the community, afraid to look ungrateful. It's also likely that the effective administrators of the program, the Mounted Police, underreported difficulties as well. Second, a sense of indebtedness developed among the Inuk settlements and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. This has to do with both the fact that the police were going to great lengths, beyond their brief, to support the Inuk, and the Inuk felt personally indebted to return the favor. And there was the fact that Inuk culture hadn't fully adopted the use of currency yet. They still relied heavily on a barter and exchange system. Thus, we have reports of Inuk asking not to be paid for their manual labor, or for their handicrafts and quilts that they were handing over. These were given as gifts or repayments. However, considering the wider circumstances, it's hard to see this as remotely fair. But why couldn't Inuit return south when they wanted to? The answer, annoyingly, is mostly cost. It was easy to transport them north because supply ships that needed to resupply the police outposts could carry them up on their way. Once supplies were delivered, the ships could not make the same trip south through that winding, ice-infested channel. Instead, they would loop around the islands and make a safer return trip back through Hudson Bay. The ship would not set out again until the next season, which meant a second transport would be needed for any Inuit who took this route south. This is one of those banality of evil things you see in history, because it just is so easily remedied. Because of the route that the ships took, it was just less expensive to send people north than to bring them south. The only timely way to go south was through a specially chartered plane or ship. And while this would sometimes happen, as in the case of extreme illness, like when a tuberculosis wave or a measles wave swept through the population, but outside of medical emergency, the Northern Administration was adamant that if any Inuit wanted to return home, the community had to pay for it. Of course, due to the mishandling of their funds, there was no way for the community to make enough money to charter a return for more than a few members at a time. Even today, it's possible to get trapped in Resolute. Without outside help, it's hard to make enough money there to pay for passage out of the place. And perhaps the greatest tragedy of this is that the greater Inuk community wanted to incorporate the settlements of Resolute and Grace Fjord into their communities, but the scarcity of contact made it impossible. A constable in charge of the Grace Fjord area suggested that while it was difficult to live there for extended periods of time, it could be a very meaningful and restorative place for Inuit to spend a few years to get acquainted with their traditional hunting and trapping methods. And returning participants could help the greater community become more self-reliant, which was the stated purpose of the project. It seems possible that this whole catastrophe could have become a positive experience for the greater Inuk community. Unfortunately, the opinions of the Inuk and their Mountie partners were largely ignored. Up to this point, I've stuck mainly to information that was documented at the time. But the official record is composed entirely of the official reports, written by people who, if they didn't have a vested interest in keeping the program going themselves, had an incentive to keep their bosses happy. They were also people who made very little attempt to understand the Inuk culture, language, or perspective. Virtually the only Inuk dissatisfaction we see reported directly comes from a few, quote, problem personalities who had the gall to ask for more support for the communities. But there are many acknowledged gaps in the record, documents that are referenced that have disappeared, and they might well have cast more light on the Inuk experience. In the 80s and 90s, the Inuk half of the story started to come to light as the experiment drew more public attention and criticism. The recollections and passed down stories are bleak. Extreme hunger led to ill health, with men dying before their time and women suffering miscarriage after miscarriage.
I got pregnant 6 times and I lost all of the babies because of the hardships. When I delivered another stillborn baby, actually I delivered twins that were stillborn. The police heard about this and he came to ask me, "Why can't your children live?" I kept a lot of things in my mind, and I want to answer him. But as usual, I kept these things in my mind. What I want to say was, it is because you place us here where there is no heat. I have been trying to make heat, and I miscarried these little human beings. But I didn't say anything.
Anything.
Children grew up in a strange, dark, cold world of extreme privation. As time went on, they went to schools where they learned Western disdain for their own culture. This is how Tommy Ikulak remembers it.
In school, we were taught the white way, the white culture. Being in school was stressed that the Inuk way was no longer the way. So these kids, us, wanted to be white, but our parents couldn't be white. It was, they had this something that we didn't know anything about that. They keep trying to preach us, but we didn't want to hear it.
Eventually, the restrictions around fraternization between Inuk and white police and military personnel were dropped, initially, unofficially, just out of mercy. Inuit were then allowed access to alcohol, and as many people who experience cold, dark winters can attest, alcohol became a constant companion.
And the people I was living with were happy at the same time, too, but people started drinking. And I guess they got to drink more and more, and then they would say, there's another place where we used to live. They used to tell me that, but I couldn't really believe them, that there was another place on Earth.
Unlooked after children gathered together in whichever homes they could heat, sometimes fleeing neglect or abuse.
Sometimes from one house to another, we would be running away from fightings or drunks, and then we would go to another family, and there'd just be kids there and nobody else taking care of them. And one of the things I really remember is the stove was out. I didn't know how to operate a diesel heating stove. And I had my brother on my back and some kids around, and these kids were half naked. And they were freezing, eh? You could hear them moving their jaws. And there was no heat in the house. And this was in the middle of winter, in the dark.
Older children became surrogate parents for their community, bearing great responsibilities at a young age. They looked with disgust and pity on their parents, who were afflicted with the deep despondency. The parents felt betrayed and abandoned by the authorities, and the children felt betrayed and abandoned by their parents. And as these children grew, they inherited their parents' anger and inherited a disgust for what they saw as the failings of their culture, a distrust of the old ways. The communities of Resolute and Grease Fjord still exist today, with populations around 200 and 120 individuals, respectively. Life has become more stable with the influx of high Arctic tourism, but remains largely subsistence-based. They still rely on the same cooperatives to acquire their supplies. Improvements in communication and technology have helped reconnect them to their fellow Inuk, and a renewed interest has developed in traditional ways of living. Artists and poets have come from these communities and have done much work to reclaim their identity and share their stories. In 1990, the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Aboriginal Affairs, a committee of the Canadian House of Commons tasked with researching and writing legislation related to Native Canadian affairs, called for a formal apology from the Northern Administration for the relocations and a recognition of the Inuk contribution to Canadian sovereignty in the North. The then minister, Tom Seiden, of the Northern Administration, rejected this recommendation and commissioned a private counseling firm to give a second opinion. This commission found that because sovereignty was not the, quote, primary motive for the relocations, no apology or compensation would be necessary. This caused a flurry of scholarship to appear, to which this podcast is entirely indebted. The issue did not go away. 3 years later, public demand led to further hearings, and while the Northern Administration pointed to missing documents as unresolvable, many valiant researchers found plentiful evidence that the motivations, policy decisions, and underfunding led to grave, unnecessary hardship due to wrongheaded and culturally chauvinistic leadership. Even so, the federal government did not apologize,
But in 1996, a fund was created to improve the settlements and provide travel for those who wanted to leave. In 1996, they finally got around to doing this. Think about that. Many people of the older generation chose to return to the communities where their parents had come from, but many of their children chose to stay and improve the settlements.
It was a happy event when we returned, because it was the way it used to be, for the stones to be warm and the plants to grow. So I was excited when we were about to arrive. But part of our lives, the people who were supposed to be here with us, the ones we have left in Inukjuaq, had passed away. It could not be helped.
The first time when I really woke up was when I went to Frobisher. There was this black guy that was working there. He made me realize by talking to me about life, the white society, the black society, the whole world. I mean, he started to put things in my head that, hey, I can be something different other than being a drunk and a troublemaker, and realize that what happened in Resolute wasn't right. He made me realize that there was a better way of life. No matter how much abuse and how much violence and how many deaths and suicides you have seen, if you know yourself, you'll be okay. And I realized that day that I didn't have to be bad, that there was another way of life. Maybe what my parents used to say in Resolute Bay, that there was a better place to live, a better way of life. Maybe they were telling me the truth. And that day I woke up that there was something else outside, that I should be confident in. The Inuk culture had its good points.
Finally, in 2010, John Duncan, the then Minister for Indian Affairs and Northern Development, gave a complete apology for the hardship and suffering caused by the relocation. He apologized for the lack of supply, the broken promise of return, the misinformation, and acknowledged the Inuk contribution to sovereignty. The following month after the apology, two statues were unveiled. Carved from wood by Ludi Pijamani and Simeoni Amagolik of Grease Fjord and Resolute, respectively, they memorialize the sacrifices of their communities. In Grease Fjord, a woman, young boy, and husky gaze out towards Resolute Bay. From Resolute, a lone man looks back. They stand in the frozen tundra, banked by snow, surrounded by barren rock, far from home, yearning to be reunited. This commemorates the sacrifices of the relocated. I've heard it said that Americans will always do the right thing, right after they've tried every other alternative. It seems like our northern neighbors might not be too different, at least in this respect. I'm Peter McGuire, and this has been my unlikely explanation. ¶¶